Hearts of Steel explores the time of the Royal Navy from the end of World War I to the Battle of Crete, which is May 1941. During the period, the Royal Navy was taking the flight to the German war machine. There were losses and great victories too. This is a unique tale following the service record of an able seaman of the period. It's a fascinating book into the senior service. I should say that joining me live on the line is author of Hearts of Steel, Jim Carter. Jim, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Thanks very much for having me on today.
Pleasure is all mine. This is a fascinating period of time because we go from the senior service, the Royal Navy, Britain's foreign policy in, you know, a heavily armed foreign policy. We go from the time of the dreadnought all the way through to the emergence of the aircraft carrier and a fundamental shift on how the Britain's armed forces and particularly the senior service do their business.
Absolutely. Yeah. So basically, there's a modernization of the Royal Navy, certainly leading up to World War One that brought on a dreadnought, as you say. Admiral Jackie Fisher did all that. And he sort of took the Navy from the age of sail and the ironclads into the modern Navy as it became. And then during that interwar period, there was a slight reduction in the size of the Royal Navy, but not massively. Typical is very similar to what's going on today, really. Then leading up to the Second World War, there was this massive rebuilding of the Navy as fast as they possibly could to counter the German war machine. And as you say, that did lead into the development of the aircraft carrier, which really took over from the battleship later on.
And you've based this around the story, if you like, of one man. Is there a relation of yours? How do you get this primary source?
Yeah, sure. So my great grandfather was an able seaman, and he joined the Royal Navy in July 1918, just as effectively as the war was ending. And it's quite interesting because he actually come from an incredibly poor background. He was from Norfolk originally, a little place called Swanton Novas, and his family had gone into the workhouse. They were very, very poor, not a lot of prospects. He started to work on the railways, and then obviously he had to go and fight when he turned 18. So he joined the RN. And he joined on for 12 years, which you see an awful lot of these able seamen who coming into the Navy do. They've got very, very little prospects. What can I do? Go into the Navy, I get paid, I get a roof over my head, all that kind of stuff. Let's sign on. So he signed on for 12 years, and that took him up to the Second World War and through it. He was nearly 40 by the time the Second World War started. But I didn't have a lot on him. I had my mother gave me a service record, but that listed all the ships that he was on, the date that he joined them, and the date that he left them. So I could then start to piece together a history of, you know, if I looked at the ships and what they were doing, I knew exactly where he was and what he would have been up to. And then I could start looking at the crews as well, other people that were interacting around him, and write a story around that.
I mean, you look at sort of how, because we just assume that you go down to your recruiting office in Portsmouth or whatever, Plymouth, whatever, and you say, I want to be in the Navy. And the next thing you know, you're given like a tot of ramen and you're flung on a boat. This is sort of, and that shows how well I know my Royal Navy, but it just doesn't work like that, does it? So there is training. There's like gunnery, for example, which is I mean, at this point, some captains, some ship commanders don't place efficiency on gunnery, but others really, really do. So that there's that aspect. And there's all sorts of sort of naval craft they need and seamanship that they need to learn.
Absolutely. And, you know, at that point, joining the Royal Navy, it was roughly one in four got accepted. So you had to be pretty much on your mettle to get into the Royal Navy. And then, as you say, they started to train them up. They had a period of probably about six months training as boys in Portsmouth before they're accepted as a seaman. And yeah, each commanding officer was slightly different in their approach, but they would have been generally looking for those young lads to be mentored by an older guy. And then in time, like Herbert became a stalwart member of the crew, and he would have been taking on lads and training them. So there was always this, you know, certainly this, let's grow the person from within, which I think remains very much so in the Royal Navy today.
And it's also a fascinating look back And depends on, because we're now, you know, in the 2020s, but then so we look at that with sort of mixed feelings. But in the 1920s, that it was empire, and again, a demonstration of your foreign policy is a robust navy, and without breaking into song, Britannia did rule the waves, and there are fascinating vignettes of what is it, hunting hippos and playing football somewhere in East Africa in front of what 100,000 or 50,000 spectators.
Yeah, so my great grandfather went on two commissions out to Ceylon, which is Sri Lanka now, which is the East Indies station. And they were 2.5 years in duration at that time.
Wow.
So they were away for an awful long time, yeah. When he first went, my grandmother was 10 months old. So by the time he got back, she was walking and talking, which gives you a breadth of that time. But they were out there flying the flag, hearts and minds. They were, you know, all the trade that we had into the UK pretty much came by sea. And came from all those different parts of the empire. So it was their job to protect those shipping lanes, but then go around, visit the local ports, entertain people, have parties aboard, show people around. But then they had to keep the morale of the ship's company up as well. Because when you're away for that long, you know, they've got to be a cohesive, happy unit. And so they would go out, they'd play a lot of games, a lot of sports, rugby, football, cricket, you name it. They'd usually do those at a, They'd visit a port or something, and then play a local garrison or a local team. And as you say, there was one match in Mauritius that 15,000 people turned up to watch, which is quite incredible when you think of 1920s. And I think the other really lovely little bit I read is that they had these radios, the radios on board ship, where they would communicate back with the UK pretty much every day. But the one thing that everybody wanted was at the weekend, they wanted to get football results first. So they got to know the football results before the press even did, basically, before it came out in the press. But as you say, they also went hunting. Some of the officers went hunting, and it probably wouldn't sit pretty with a lot of people today, but they'd go out and shoot anything in sight, basically. Yeah.
It's also a fascinating period because we have that, as I said before, we have that change from ironclads and dreadnoughts through to, more modern ships. The destroyers come in. It's the J-class destroyer, isn't it, that comes in, which is the bit of the game changer during the,
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Well, the J-class came after the tribal. So So HMS Nubian that my grandfather was on was a tribal class destroyer. And just to give you a quick indication of the difference, most of the general design of destroyers was around torpedo action.
As opposed to the gunnery, because before that, it's all big guns, isn't it? You've basically got floating castles, if you like, or floating gunnery stations.
That's right. That's exactly it. And then there was the Italians and the Japanese were starting to build these bigger destroyers based around gunnery that were almost like small cruisers. And so the Navy and the government decided, well, we'll build a similar one. So they built the tribals. So they sat in the middle of that destroyer building program, and the J's came after the tribals, and they were a return back to torpedo type action.
And let's just, for those of, you know, who are going, what? So just a quick, so you go from your very top, which is presumably your battleship, and you're thinking, you know, your huge, your huge thing. So, you know, for the Germans, that's what Graf Spee or, you know, the Kriegsmarine stuff. And then you get, is it a sort of battleship, pocket battleship, so you couldn't put one in your pocket. And then you go destroyer, and then it's cruiser, and then it's corvette and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, slightly different. So Battleships are the big ones, and there's battle cruisers that are a little bit smaller but similar size. Then the cruisers, which were the eyes and ears of the fleet, basically they'd get ahead of the fleet, try and find the enemy, and they were big enough and bad enough to deal with the enemy, but fast enough to run away if they were in trouble. And but they would hopefully draw in the battleships to then engage each other. And then it went down to destroyers and corvettes and the like, and they all had their different roles to play.
Fascinating. So we get to the early 40s or the late 30s and the early 40s. War is declared. He finds himself in the Mediterranean, Alexandria, which is again the, because he's not involved in the Battle of the Atlantic, but is involved with something much more important. And that is obviously the Italians invading, coming across and invading North Africa, throwing a spanner in the works of Hitler's plans. And the next thing you know, you've got the Italian Navy involved in seeing action on that particular front.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, the Eastern Mediterranean Fleet based out of Alexandria, their job was to basically suppress the Italian Navy as best they could, draw them out and fight them. And as you say, the Italians then were in North Africa, in Libya, and they Mussolini decided they'd have a go at trying to capture Alexandria and attempted to invade Egypt. But they effectively got pushed all the way back to Tripoli, got completely destroyed. And the Navy played a part in that. They played in replenishment, water supplies, and naval bombardment. But of course, the other thing was to try and to stop the resupply from Italy into North Africa.
Yeah.
Was to attack the convoy system that the Italians were deploying.
And of course, we've also got at this point which wasn't so much of an aspect of the First World War, the Second World War, and that's air power. And this is the thing where the whole nature of naval engagements will change. And by the time, like, for example, in the Pacific Theater, where you've got that whole scenario, that whole area of conflict is aircraft is carrier heavy.
Very much.
But this sees the gradual change, because they obviously, you've got Stukas and whatever else, and they are wreaking havoc on the Allied forces in the Mediterranean.
They certainly did. In the beginning, it was just the Italians attacking with high level bombing, and there was really no Royal Air Force cover at all. There was a handful of airplanes operating out of Malta. There was literally no air cover at all. So that was a big problem, which is why Admiral Cullingham asked for the carriers, the Illustrious, to come out, and that made a difference, because the big plus that the Italians had was they had brilliant reconnaissance, and they would go out, they'd find the fleet, and then within an hour, there'd be high-level bombers overhead. So bringing in being Illustrious took the fight back to that reconnaissance and kept them away. But in 1941, Hitler decided to send troops and the Air Force, the Luftwaffe, down to the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
And that was a big game changer. That's where they really started to hammer our forces, and our lack of air cover became a massive problem. And that was borne out at Preet when we lost about eight or nine ships through, and loads. I mean, the Eastern Mediterranean Fleet was pretty much decimated at the Battle of Crete.
Is the Battle of Crete anything to do with the actual invasion of Crete with the Fauschenjäger?
Yeah.
It is. Right. Okay. So talk us through it.
Yeah. So basically Greece fell. So we'd sent a load of troops out to Greece. They were mainly ANZACs, Australian, New Zealand forces, and British forces. They'd gone out to Greece. Half of the troops that have been operating in North Africa were taken away and sent to Greece, coinciding with Rommel arriving in North Africa and pushing them all back. Our guys in Greece, they were fighting a losing battle as well. They were forced out of Greece. The Royal Navy evacuated them back to Crete. And then almost it was inevitable that Crete was going to be attacked, and that was an airborne invasion by the Germans, very costly for them, but they won that. And of course, that was yet another evacuation situation, and the Royal Navy was involved in bringing all the troops they could out of Crete and taking them back to North Africa.
It's must be a tremendous strain on a crewman, because so all you're seeing is basically, the Allies losing. You're taking people off this island and off that shoreline. And at the same time, you've got submarines, you've got the Italian Air Force, you've got the German Air Force. I mean, the Luftwaffe. And at the same time, you're in a ship. So at any point, you could get, you can, this is before Pedestal, isn't it? This is before the relief of Malta. Yeah. Right. So
yes,
at which point Malta's getting hammered. I mean, Malta's getting absolutely crocked. And, Pedestal, where they come over and they try, Malta's about to go as well. So it's not, we always look back and think, oh, well, because we've got rose colored spectacles, and we go, okay, fine. Well, we know at the end, the good will fight. But at that point, they don't. So at that point, it's not looking good at all. And they must be thinking, we're stuck in the Eastern Mediterranean. Will we ever get past Gibraltar, and will we ever see England again, sort of thing?
Absolutely. They were an awful long way from home. And they certainly in the destroyers, they were out nearly every day. So the stress and the strain on those guys was immense. And you can see that through some of the writing from the commanders, in that they were, certainly there's a chap called Roger Hill, who was in Pedestal as well. And he had a nervous breakdown, and he writes about that in his book, Destroyer Captain, in that he was trying to show this stiff upper lip, but they were getting bombed all the time. He was frightened out of his wits, and but he kept this persona on the bridge that everything was fine. And then once they got out of trouble, he'd go down to his cabin and be violently sick, and hide himself away. And that's a pretty big revelation. He's probably the one guy that I've really read of that has come out with the fact that how that affected him and how he ended up with this nervous breakdown.
But if you think about it, if you've seen things like the Cruel Sea, and read the book and seen the movie, although they may say, oh, it's only fifties filming, but it's incredibly true to life. And you're sitting up there in an open conning tower. The bridge is open. It's not like Americans having closed bridges. And the stress of having a couple of hundred men under your command. And your misjudgment can send you all to the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea must be incredible.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And Nubian's captain as well. There's an instance. Funny enough, the surgeon commander on Nubian that my grandfather served with, he wrote a paper on morale that was circulated to the fleet as a battle order, actually. And that went on to be in a book by Lord Moran, who was Churchill's physician, which was The Anatomy of Courage. And in it, he talks about Ravenhill, who again sat on the bridge having a cup of tea, bombs falling all around him, and everybody thought he was an absolute hero. And he shot downstairs afterwards and cried his eyes out in the cabin. I mean, it's a massive responsibility. But on the flip side, if you look at the guys inside this in that steel can, they've got nowhere to go. If you were frightened to death, you can't just get off. Because you're stuck there.
Yeah, no, exactly. And again, the other thing is they've got to, at all costs, protect Illustrious. Because if you lose, a flagship, like a carrier, then that completely that completely changes the. Because later on, it's all about supply and it's all about the shipping. And when the Royal Navy finally gets the thing, and we've got the Desert Air Group with Maori Cunningham, and they're bashing the hell out of Rommel and whatever, and the Italians can't resupply because they're getting sunk left, right, and center. I mean, that's when the Royal. But so the tide will turn. But at the same time, they must protect Illustrious at all costs. Otherwise, the whole thing changes.
That's right, and interestingly, so Illustrious did get hammered big style. In fact, there was a directive from Hitler when the Flieger Corps 10 went out there in January 1941. The directive to them was to sink Illustrious. You've got to get rid of it. And they practiced like mad, and they nearly did. I mean, it got really badly damaged, as I'm sure you know, went into Malta and then was out of the war for about a year. Mm. And then they bought in Formidable. So again, that shows you the size of the Navy at the time and the breadth of the Navy. Is that, okay, we've lost a carrier. Here's another one.
Yeah.
So Formidable came in, but you're right in that particular asset needed protecting big style because it was such a key component. The only trouble is it's only as good as it is when it's got aircraft aboard it.
Yeah.
So the big trouble that they had, especially with Formidable, was that it had a complement of aircraft which gradually got eroded over a period of time and wasn't replaced. Mm. So by the time of the Battle of Crete, they only had about half a dozen aircraft left available to them to be effective.
And that's the important point, isn't it? Because you can have all the heavy metal that you want, but you need to have the men who are skilled in either flying or sailing or manning it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. And it's quite interesting, just to go back to that point, when Illustrious and Formidable first came out, they were state-of-the-art piece of equipment, just like Prince of Wales and Queen Elizabeth is today. Mm. But they didn't really have the right aircraft to fly off them. And that's exactly the same as we had just recently.
History doesn't repeat itself, but it sends echoes, doesn't it, down the path, ripples down the past.
Yeah, it sure does. Yeah, it sure does.
What's it like going through then and finding this information and putting meat on the bone or colour into the sort of the monochrome for you?
Oh, I've loved it. I mean, I've been interested in military history since I was a kid. So it was quite an easy. Once I found that I thought, okay, I've got a story here. Actually, doing the research, going up to the National Archives, the Imperial War Museum, buying books. I mean, when I started it, I had about 3 or 4 books on the Royal Navy, and I thought, oh, that's probably all I'll need. And I've ended up with about 50. I've ended up with about 50. I've ended up with so many. My wife's been very tolerant of me, but
you're probably great. Like me, you've got one of those bookcases that you have to keep out of sight from the visitors, because when they come round, if it's in the living room, you know, you're going to put the curtain over it.
Yeah, near enough. Yeah, it's a bit sad, really. Yeah, but it was quite fun. Corey, carry on.
I was just going to say, but again, it is family, so you must be incredibly kind of proud, but also you've got that insight because it's kind of in the DNA there as well.
Yeah, that's right. And that was, the whole point of doing it was just to give my kids and their relations some idea of what their great-grandfather did. But it ended up in this monster that was a book. So, it was great fun to do.
But it's been very, very, very well received because you're doing a lot of press at the moment. You've got an interview or you're booked in this afternoon as well, I believe, somewhere else. So you must be incredibly pleased that it's being received so well.
Yeah, it's been great. Yeah, I've had a great help from Kelly Pike, my publicist, and we've been doing an awful lot. So we've got History with Jackson this afternoon, and then I'm talking at Chalk Valley History Festival in June. So there's lots going on, which is great fun to do. Like today, this is really nice.
I know. I'm aware. Chalk, it's one of the big ones. So that'll be an amazing experience. The book is called Hearts of Steel. It's by Jim Carter. Jim, what do you hope the people will take from your book?
I think the main thing is to look at the sacrifice and the time and the sacrifice that our guys gave to make life as good as it is today. Really, you know, they should never be forgotten, and that's my homage to my great grandfather and all those guys.
The book is called Hearts of Steel. It's by Jim Carter. Jim, are you on the socials? Where can people find you online?
Yep, so I'm on Facebook, Jim Carter Online, and I'm on LinkedIn, same thing, on Twitter, although I don't do a lot of it, but you can find me there. And I've got a website, jimcarter.online as well.
The book is called Hearts of Steel. It's by Jim Carter. Jim, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Likewise, Giles. Really nice to talk to you. Thanks a lot for having me.